This is Dan Austin. The date is Thursday, October 11, 1990. And what I'm going to put on this tape are a few, based on a few notes that I had taken when I met with Cliff Mapes, Charlie Severa, Tom Ferrick, and Tommy Hendrick in New York City when in the middle of September this past month, that these were not on the tape that I had sent to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. I'm not sure who, which one of the players mentioned these, although Tom Ferrick had a tremendous knowledge of baseball. Charlie Severa had one story after another, and Tommy Hendrick, of course, probably is the baseball storyteller of all times. Cliff Mapes, a much more shy, reserved fellow compared to the other three. A huge man. I bet in his heyday, Cliff had a chest of 48. I think he stood about 6'3", probably weighed 215-220 pounds. He was my childhood hero when he played center field for the Kansas City Blues back in 1947, the team that won the American Association pennant, and all but one of those players went on to the major leagues. Billy Meyer, the manager, went on to manage the Pittsburgh Pirates, but that's an incredible accomplishment for a team to achieve. At first base on that Kansas City Blues team was Steve Souchock, who then went up the Yankees, was traded to the White Sox, a World War II hero, later broke his leg in the early 50s, but he is in his 52nd year of professional baseball, now scouting for the Detroit Tigers. Some of the stories, as I jotted down these notes, this one was told by Tommy Hendrick. Old Reliable, as he was called, played right field, came up with the Yankees in 1937, and as I had dinner and breakfast with him that weekend, here I was sitting next to a fellow who played with the likes of Joe DiMaggio, Lou Gehrig, managed by Joe McCarthy, catcher Bill Dickey, Spud Chandler, one of the greatest competitive pitchers of all time. Charlie Keller, Charlie King Kong Keller, who died earlier this year of cancer. Johnny Lindell played left field. Joe Collins at first base, that is after World War II. Incredible talent of pitchers. But anyway, I asked Tommy Hendrick what was one of the qualities that made the Yankees so fierce with pride, and he gave me this story about Charlie Keller, who came up with the Newark Bears, which was the Yankee Triple-A club in the International League. And with Newark, he hit 360. He was a spray hitter to the alleys. But when he was brought up to the Yankees, the stories came ahead of him of his incredible strength, thus the nickname King Kong. Of course, that movie came out in the earlier in the 30s. And his reputation preceded him as a home run hitter. And so he was expected to hit home runs, which cut down on his batting average. And Tommy Hendrick asked him, said, well, why did he do that? Why didn't he just say, hey, I'm a better hitter up the alleys. I don't go for the long ball. And Hendrick, without blinking, he said, well, there was that attitude. You did those things because you were a Yankee, that you didn't attempt on any other team. I think that's illustrative of indeed the pride. And Tom Ferrick mentioned that over again as he played for a number of teams. Came up with the Philadelphia A's under Connie Mack, traded to the Cleveland Indians. In fact, Tom Ferrick said that in 2 years, he went from being managed by the oldest manager in professional baseball, Connie Mack, to the youngest, Lou Boudreau. Tom mentions about Connie Mack. He said he had tremendous influence in the American League. And I said, you know, Connie Mack was the only baseball manager that never wore a uniform. He was a tall, thin man in the stature of Washington Irving's character, Ichabod Crane. Always wore a straw hat. I said, why didn't he ever wear a uniform? He said, well, if you had a build of Connie Mack, you wouldn't wear one either. And I said, you know, I've looked at a lot of newsreels, read a lot of stories, but I never recall Connie Mack ever going out on the baseball field during the game. He said, you're right, Connie Mack never did. He had somebody else deliver the lineup. And if he wanted an umpire's attention during the game, he'd send his son behind the home plate screen who would holler to the ump. The ump would turn around, call timeout, hear what the messenger had to say, which was, Connie Mack wants to see you. He'd call timeout, walk over, sit down next to Connie Mack in the dugout, listen to what he had to say, nodded, got back out on the playing field, got behind home plate, and said, play ball. I doubt if we'll ever see a baseball manager, owner, ever wield that kind of power, let alone that an umpire would call timeout and go to the dugout of any team in baseball today to hear what the manager had to say. Of course, I guess Connie Mack wielded enough influence that he had to say as to who would be hired next year as umpires. Tom Ferrick, who is a scout for the Kansas City Royals now, lives in suburban Philadelphia, and a knowledgeable baseball man. He had a lot of beautiful stories. One of them was that about Eddie Lopat, who came up with the Cleveland, or the White Sox, I believe, traded to the Yankees in the late 40s, and had a fantastic career. He said he never knew a pitcher that had more pitches than Eddie Lopat. His fastball probably came in about 70 miles an hour. He had a screwball, slider. He said he could make that ball droop, hop, dip, what we call the old submarine pitch. But he said what really got to the batters was that Eddie Lopat was a fantastic gymnast, and he had a way of cocking and moving his whole body that would disrupt the attention of the batter, and so by the time he pitched, the batter really never knew what kind of junk was coming up to home plate, and that really got Eddie Lopat, who was not an overpowering pitcher, but one that had more junk than virtually anybody else in the major leagues in the 40s and early 50s. About pitchers, Tom Ferrick also mentioned about Stu Miller, another junk pitcher. He had a way about moving his neck. They called it the double neck N-E-C-K job. Anyway, when Stu Miller would pitch, he would do what Tom Ferrick described, the double neck job. He would, just before he would release the ball, he would twist his neck back and forth twice as if it was about ready to fall off his shoulders, disrupting again the attention of the batter, and turned out to be a very effective pitcher. Spud Chandler, all of those players that I met, talked with that weekend, a Yankee pitcher in the 40s, agreed that there was never in that era, a more competitive pitcher. He didn't like anybody coming to the mound to give him any advice. He would just tell them to get their ass back over to their position. This was his territory, and he didn't mean to have any first baseman, third baseman, or anybody else come up there and tell him what to do or try to settle him down. When he went out to pitch, he had absolute concentration. About Jim Turner, who was a pitching coach for the Yankees for a good number of years, Tommy Hendricks said that one of his favorite expressions whenever the Yankee pitchers weren't doing too well and they were the opposing batters were really getting to them, and especially after a bad game, his favorite expression when they would come into the dugout would say, "Gentlemen, we got to keep our mistakes to a minimum." I guess that was Jim Turner's favorite advice. I'm sure he had a lot more to offer than that. But Tom Hendrick did say that, in those days, when by the time you got up to the major leagues, you didn't have a lot of pitching coaches and batting coaches. You were expected to know those fundamentals before you even made it, compared to today where you can get up to the majors much more quickly than you could 30, 40 years ago. Back in the 30s and 40s, you could spend 4 or 5 years in the minor leagues learning the basics. Today, a lot of those players learn some of the basics with the help of pitching and batting coaches, fielding coaches, when they get to the majors. Also, about Spud Chandler, that one of his favorite expressions, if he saw a batter digging in at home at the plate, he said, that batter needs a little lesson. He needs some chin music. I think Whitey Ford likewise played a little bit of chin music. Charlie Severa, and I forget about who he was thinking, who he was talking about, but I heard him give this expression describing one of them. He said that player could make Jell-O nervous. And about another player, he said this guy is going to have a short funeral because he doesn't have any friends. Tom Farrick, who later pitched for the Kansas City Athletics when they moved there in 1955, and in the late 50s, I think Rocky Colavito was traded by the who came up with the Cleveland organization, was a streak hitter. He could bang out home runs in a week, 10 days time, and then strike out 90% of the other for the next rest of the month. But Charlie Finley, I think by that time, owned the Kansas City A's. And the way the story goes, that he was going to give Rocky Colavito $300 or $3,000 to Rocky Colavito if he would hit his 300th home run in Kansas City. And Tom relates a story that here the A's came back playing on a homestand, and this was the deal. And all of a sudden, when they got to the ballpark and everything, they saw a couple of motorcycles, cops, and an armored truck. Supposedly, the money was inside the armored truck, and the cops were there to protect it. Well, anyway, Rocky, who had quite a assorted gymnastics when he'd come up to bat. He'd do arm stands. He'd take the bat, one arm on the handle, the other one at the height of the barrel, tip of the barrel, and put it back behind him, do knee waist bends, rotate it around, and he had a very systematic gymnastic exercise there before he came up to bat to get ready. And so here was coming up to hit home run number 300, and here comes Rocky, gets his bearing, gets his attention, and the pitcher gets set, and all of a sudden the motorcycles warm up, and they go, and turn on the sirens. Well, Rocky, he gets waylaid by all of that, and every time he came up to bat during that whole homestand, that went on. The motorcycles would go, Rocky never did hit a home run, never did get the $3,000, hit the home run on the road. Went 0 for 25 in that homestand. Those were the main stories that came to my mind that, oh yeah, Tom Farrick said, there was, I said, I heard there was a pitch called the double curve. And he said, yeah, there was a double curve. It was perfected by a Philadelphia A's pitcher by the name of John Knott, K-N-O-T-T. And I said, just exactly what was a double curve? And he said, well, just what it meant to be. It would, when Knott would start pitching and he would release the ball, he was a right-hander, it would go toward the outside of the plate to a right-hand batter, and then all of a sudden would whip back in and come in toward the inside corner. And he taught that to a few other pitchers, but that was the double curve pitch. Those are some of the stories that I remember that they told that evening of some several hours of talking baseball. End of comments.